Go ahead and call the Finance Committee to order, 9 a.m., actually 5 after. April 24th, 2007. Joining me today is Co-Chair Senator Hoffman, Senator Olson, Senator Huggins, Senator Elton, Senator Thomas, Senator Dyson. Today's meeting is going to be concerning Senate Bill 104, the Gas Line Inducement Act, better known by the acronym AGIA. This morning, the plans to let the administration continue their presentation and walk through the bill. And what we don't finish, we're going to pick it back up at 3 o'clock today and hope to finish that up today. And we'll reconvene, deal with whatever we have to deal with at the end of the bill. There's been a lot of interest in the committee schedule dealing with this bill, and there's been some glitches with the posting, and they are what they are. But we'll be working on this bill. The plan is virtually nonstop over the next 2 weeks. The intent here is to get the bill on the table, have the administration walk through the bill, and then for me to get some feedback from committee members on what area of the bill, what areas in the bill that they have more concern or interest or would like more explanation on, or areas that they feel may need some work. And then we'll set up a schedule. We have the capital bill that we're working on. That's going to come up probably next week. And then there's a couple other little smaller bills. There's a cost share bill we're going to deal with tomorrow, hopefully, and get that out. But we're going to have a pretty full schedule. My recommendation, the people that are interested in any of these bills, that they don't get far from this committee room. We'll most likely be working through the weekends. And the items within this bill have been pretty much flushed out, and a lot of background information already put together. So I'm not expecting a lot of preparatory work from the industry. And there'll be more information coming from the administration on some of the items, but we're going to get a layout of the calendar a little more clear as we move through this process of walking through the bill, and I get a sense for where the committee members are on the bill. Senator Huggins has been with the bill for the other two committees, both resources and judiciary. I was also on the resources committee. Some of the other committee members haven't been exposed to the bill as much as none of us have been, as much as Senator Huggins. So if we have to back up and fill in spaces, we'll do that. But the intent here is not to push us into a special session. So we're going to try to get this bill done. Again, I wouldn't plan on going far from the room. With that, we have with us today Ms. Marcia Davis, Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Revenue, to walk through the bill. Rumor is that you were up fairly late last night, so you're not going to dazzle us with some fancy overhead. You're going to just do it the old-fashioned way. She was up late last night dealing with the House Resources Amendments. With that, Ms. Davis, if you could introduce yourself and who you represent, and then walk through the bill, I'd appreciate it.
Thank you, Senator Stedman. My name is Marcia Davis. I'm Deputy Commissioner for Department of Revenue, and I'm here to walk you through this bill on a sectional analysis. I'm glad you added what I was busy doing into the wee hours of the night, lest anyone have the wrong impression of my off hours in Juneau, especially from afar, like spouses. So I appreciate that. The AGEA bill is by now somewhat familiar to everyone, I'm sure. However, the structure, the key structures as it's moved through the committee process has stayed intact, and I could probably characterize it as follows. It's essentially government taking a soft touch. It's government stepping in and looking at a situation that has not moved on its own under normal market forces, and for whatever reason, either because of the structure of the ownership patterns at Prudhoe, the structure of global gas markets, or simply the time has not come. But one thing that has come is the time for the state of Alaska to do whatever it can do to move the gas and ensure that the time for the revenue stream flowing from that gas happens at the soonest moment feasible given market conditions. So what the bill is designed to do is provide a set of inducements for two pieces. One, induce the construction of the bill, and two, ensure the success of that constructed pipeline by inducing resource owners to commit gas to that pipeline. So it's two-prong, and it's the bill you'll see is structured in sections that comport with that dual purpose of the bill. With that said, I'd like to walk through the bill, and if everyone has the committee substitute for Senate Bill number 104, Judiciary, that's the structure I'll be walking through. Article 1 describes the inducements for the construction of the pipeline, and it starts off with a section, .02010, called Purpose. The purpose of this bill has not changed through its different committee hearings. It's obviously designed, as I said, to facilitate the commercialization of the gas, in addition, promote its exploration and development, as constitutionally mandated, maximize the benefit of that gas resource to the people of the state of Alaska, and finally, to encourage oil and gas lessees to commit gas to that pipeline. Article 2 sets out specifically the inducement structure, which is the grant of an Alaska Gas Line Inducement Act license. Section 100 is entitled Gas Project, and this is the section that tees up the grant of a license to a person that applies for a license under this chapter and meets all the requirements set out in the chapter. An important addition that was added to the administration's bill is subsection B. Federal law mandates that the state cannot interfere with the construction of a interstate pipeline other than as allowed through its administration of permitting and the pieces that are properly within the domain of the state to regulate. However, it was felt by earlier legislators that because of concerns we heard expressed from the industry that somehow this was an exclusive arrangement, that somehow this would prevent the construction of other pipelines. An emphatic statement was added under B of Section 100, which states that nothing in this section precludes a person pursuing a gas pipeline independently from this chapter. So we wanted to make sure and make that point.
If someone applies for the AGEA license and is not successful, would they then be precluded from going and building their own line, doing their own project?
Senator Stebbins, no, they would not be precluded. Okay. Section 110 outlines the actual pipeline construction inducement. And the key part of this inducement is the grant by the state of up to $500 million. And the $500 million is granted in two phases. It's granted in part at a level prior to open season that cannot exceed 50%. The bill has gone through incarnations as well there where it's moved from being a mandated 50% match to now what it requires is simply a match of up to 50%, and it leaves open to the applicant to bid in their applicant what portion of match they would like in that period of time up to the open season. The second phase is after the open season, and again, it is now, it was and still is capped at 80%. So whatever the expenditures are after open season, the applicant can bid in their application for a state match of up to 80%. To give a frame of reference for the numbers, roughly the amount of money that we've heard mentioned in testimony for the cost to go from the grant of the license up to the open season has varied anywhere from in the 50 to 80 million, and that was an estimate by a party that had a license already in place and was looking to essentially amend their license, up to 400 million by both a producer and another independent pipeline company. So if you look at a state match of up to 50% of those amounts, that gives you roughly a benchmark for how much state capital would be expended, anywhere from, say, as low as 30 million up to 200 million in the first 3 years after the grant of the license. And I say 3 years because in the bill it gives the applicant up to 36 months before they must initiate their open season. After the open season, the remainder of the cost associated with moving from open season up to a FERC certification, we've heard estimated in testimony to be approximately up to $1 billion. So you can assume another additional increment of cost on top of whatever the estimate was for open season. Recognizing that the state's grant is limited to $500 million by virtue of whatever match percentage they recommend or ask for in their application, you'll either see that chunk of change from the state be on the front end of the remaining part of the process. In other words, if they ask for an 80% match and the remainder of the cost is $600 million, you'd see the state matching 80 cents on the dollar up until the full $500 million was expended, and from that point forward, it's 100% on the nickel of the applicant.
We'll start with Senator Thomas, then we'll go to Senator Elton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple of quick questions, and not to back up too far, just almost yes and no. Mm-hmm. Article 2, paragraph B, or line 10 anyhow, of page 2 says, nothing in this section precludes a person pursuing a gas line independently from this chapter. We understand that that's accurate, but they are not eligible for the favored treatment under this agreement then, obviously. Is that correct? Or?
Senator Thomas, strictly speaking, nothing precludes the state from granting the tax, royalty, cash relief, whatever the state would like to give another project. It can. However, doing so for a competing pipeline project would have a financial consequence to the state under the bill.
Okay, that's something that I'd pursue at a later date when we get mm-hmm. to that particular section, how it may relate back to the statement made here. That's good for now. Thank you.
Okay.
Senator Elton.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Can I just repeat a process, and you can tell me whether it's correct or not? So the licensee would make an application to the executive branch for reimbursement up to the $500 million. The executive then would come to the legislature and ask for an appropriation of whatever was asked for to the licensee. Is that kind of the way the process works?
The first part of the process is correct. The second part of the process, there is in AGEA a provision to provide for a fund that would be funded by the legislature and be available for those matching funds. So I don't believe it would be a match-by-match appropriation from the legislature, but certainly the legislature would appropriate funds, monies to that fund that would then be available for the matching. That is correct. The legislature would appropriate the funds for that matching purpose.
And if I could follow up, so is the expectation the legislature appropriates $500 million or would do it piecemeal over time?
Senator Elton, through the chair, it would be expected that would be piecemeal.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator?
Yes.
Huggins.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Marcia, when you go down on line 17, on page number 2, it talks about extending the 5-year period. Number 1, is there a limit to how long you can extend? And then could you talk us through the scenarios that would bring about the extension?
Yes, Senator Huggins, through the chair. The ability to extend the period for payment, that is brought about by the fact that the $500 million as currently written is required to be matched and expended in the first 5 years after the license is issued. There is no time limit established by AGIA to require a backstop date for the filing for the FERC certification process. However, the funds can only be used up through the first 5 years, as written. In the, I believe it was the last committee, I'm pretty sure it was the last committee group, had some concern that, again, depending upon what happened in the process from issuance of license up through the FERC certification process, there could be very reasonable and appropriate reasons why the 5 years would need to be extended for matching of funds. Or let me put it this way, certainly why there might be a need for more than 5 years to get to that FERC certification process. And given that they did not want to have applicants behaving in an economically irrational fashion so that they would, say, push expenses into earlier periods just to be able to get matching, they want applicants to, you know, incur costs in a rational way that makes sense for the process. There was the thought that we should allow for an extension of that payment period if it made sense. The bill has a provision that talks to when can the project plan, which is captured in the license, be modified. And that provision in the bill, which we will get to, allows for modification under circumstances where it would improve the net present value to the state, where it's required because of changes by the AOGCC in their offtake rules, gas offtake rules, and third, in situations where the conditions were unexpected and out of the control of the applicant. So envisioning, those are the three conditions under which a deadline could be extended or modified by the commissioners in those three situations.
Senator Hoffman, we would follow up with Senator Huggins and then Senator Hoffman.
Yeah, Marcia, the one, if you could give us a little bit more insight into the conditions that would be outside the control of the licensee, what that really means.
Okay. In an open season, you could be in a situation where the pipeline company is going to do everything in its power to develop the economics, the design, all of the appropriate bone structure around their project, so that when they go to an open season and ask the market, the shippers, to enter into a commitment to ship gas on their line, they've given those shippers a good, solid, what's still an estimate though, since the pipeline hasn't been built, such that shippers will come forward. And there'll be two situations. One, they'll ship, and two, they won't ship. If they choose not to ship, it could be for two reasons. One is that despite the best efforts of that pipeline company, they have not given enough assurance to that shipper that they've nailed the economics, that they've properly handled the cost overruns, et cetera. And in that situation, you'd be looking at a shipper who still hasn't been convinced that that project is economic and that they're willing to enter into that contractual commitment. There's another situation where a shipper might not tender their gas, and that would be because their own personal economics or personal politics might require them, you know, to not tender the gas because they are looking at doing something else at a different time frame or in a different setting. In that situation, you've got a pipe company that has essentially done everything reasonable, everything appropriate that they need to do. And there is really not much more they can do on the front of proving up their economics, proving up the case for their pipeline company if that gas is still being withheld. In that instance, the FERC has stated under the Alaska Natural Gas Act that they consider this gas critical to the nation, critical to its energy supplies, and that they will proceed notwithstanding the lack of a commitment of that gas to that pipeline. However, it's a slightly different process. It's a perhaps a longer process and will involve more congressional involvement. And that's a situation where we would envision that the administration, as well as the PIPECO, should hold firm, keep their feet on the line, and move that project forward. But it might take a longer period of time for them to get to that FERC certification process. So we're trying to make sure that we have given all the support we can to a pipeline company to proceed in good faith and with good science and good economics. And when they do so, stick with them to get them through that process. Since we're asking them in return to commit that they will go through an open season, and if it's unsuccessful, progress on to a FERC certificate, notwithstanding that.
Marcia, could I get you to pull your mic a little bit closer, because I've got a keyboard that's in one side of me, and then have a one follow-up, Senator Huggins, and we'll go to Senator Hoffman.
If I might, Mr. Chairman, that what Marcia described is one of the things that continues to disturb me, that because if we remember our packet yesterday that talked about when we extend the project, what it cost, the dollars, and then this scenario, I think what we're really doing is we're upping our payment level to 80% in the period when we're extending the project. So it's counterintuitive that we're it's costing us more on both ends of the, in both scenarios, 80% expenditure, and oh, by the way, we extended the length of the project. And that just concerns me, the risk factor that we're in. I don't have an answer to it, but it, mm-hmm. but it continues to concern me.
Senator Huggins, through the chair, one of the other sort of counterintuitive part is because the $500 million is capped, the fact that we would extend it, if we haven't expended the full $500 million, a mitigating factor would be that at least the funds that we're matching out past the 5 years are later in time. So at least as far as time value of money, I guess there's a little bit of a benefit, but not enough to counter what you're concerned about.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't know if you're the proper person to address this question, but has it been discussed on what would the funding source be for the $500 million, whether that be general funds, CBR, or permanent fund earnings reserve account, or any other sources that the administration might have identified?
Senator Hoffman, through the chair, to this point, no, there has not been discussion about those details, about where the funds would particularly be sourced from.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
May I please continue?
In addition, under Section 110, after describing in subsection 1 A and B the manner in which the match is split up between pre-open season, post-open season, the bill also describes and defines what types of expenses will be matched, and those have been carefully delineated as those that are directly and reasonably related to obtaining a certificate or amended certificate of public convenience and necessity. And they specifically exclude overhead costs, litigation costs, assets, work product that predate the issuance of the license, or civil or criminal penalties and fines.
Can we, Marcia, can we go back to page 2, line 27? And that's after the close of the first binding open season, the state shall match. Could you elaborate on why the word shall is used instead of the word may, in case the state has a different opinion at that time?
Mm-hmm. The issuance, once the license is issued, and again, I guess it's part of what's the frame of time of reference here, this is the promise, as it were, under Section 110, basically saying this is the terms of for which we are holding out and asking you to make an offer to us to build our pipeline. And what we're inducing is the offer to come in and agree to build the pipeline and commit your funds and your time to this project. So for the state, what we're saying that the state will do in return, we shall match funds up to 50% based on what is offered. And it's a little bit strange because this was originally written when it was mandated that it will be a 50% match no matter what. Since that time, the bill has been amended such that it is a bid variable. It is something that the applicant's going to propose. But what we want to make very clear is that once the applicant has submitted their offer, and the state accepts that offer, and it accepts it on the terms that we will match at the level that is proposed in their application, that we agree to that application, then the state is going to match it. Its commitment is akin to that of a contract. So we are committing to match at whatever level is ultimately in the application and accepted by the administration and approved by the legislature.
Sure.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just one question on page 3, the qualified expenditures. Did you not think it reasonable to allow at least a litigation cost in some specific manner related potentially to the open season if the producers were unwilling? Did you consider that as a potential and just rule that out?
Senator Thomas, through the chair, in terms of looking at the state's contribution of a total of $500 million compared to probably the total cost of up to $1 billion, we felt more comfortable having our costs match direct dollars. We felt that there was more than enough real hard dollars to match and not get into the debate of litigation costs and audit costs. In order for us to, certainly we wouldn't disagree that there are some litigation costs that you could say are directly and reasonably related, but once we got into parsing those and deciding how we would describe which ones we were willing to match and which ones we weren't willing to match, the bill started to tumble, and so we felt pretty comfortable that there was more than ample other costs that would be direct that the applicant would be able to bring forward and get a full match.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Dyson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I haven't been able to follow all of the changes that were made in the bill in the previous two committees, and I appreciate your bringing up the ones that were changed. And I guess on some level I'd like for, as we walk through this, for the administration to tell us whether or not they favor the changes that were made, in the process. I think sounds to me like several of them were actually a significant improvement. Mm-hmm. But if the administration sees that they've produced some other problems and stuff, I'd like to know that.
Well, what we can do, Senator Dyson, is we'll have the administration make a grid for us showing the amendments done in or changes done in resources, and if it was a committee or administration sponsored, along with judiciary. So you should have in your packet the changes done at the Judiciary Committee. But we can assemble that all together, have the administration assemble it all together so it's a nice, neat package. And we could not only track but count the changes, which have been numerous.
Yeah, and I appreciate that, and that'll really help me. But I'm also interested in the administration's view on the changes, and particularly the ones that they see as not being helpful.
Well, I think we can have them in their grid. They can add a column if they support it or don't support it. That's fine.
So you're saying you don't want them to comment at this table as we walk through this?
Well, they can if they want to, but I'm
okay.
You know, I thought the question was, or the interest was, having them or somebody, the committee, put together a document that shows all the changes and where they came from, what committee.
Yeah,
and then they can certainly address any potential changes that they recommend in the bill. I mean, depending on if they want to do it as they roll through this initial review of it or in coming weeks.
Okay, thank you.
The last inducement, the second inducement for construction of the pipeline, is listed on page 3, line 9, which is the benefit of an Alaska Gasline Inducement Act coordinator with the authorities described in that section. And what this inducement is the assignment of an individual analogous to the federal structure, which is the federal pipeline coordinator, the position now occupied by Ms. Drew Pierce. And the purpose of this is to again accelerate and make sure that there are absolutely, you know, no unnecessary delays in the permitting and the construction of the pipeline. In the course of the debate amongst the different constituents and interested parties, there has been concern expressed by the industry that this would result in a de facto impairment of another pipeline project. The idea that this project has a pipeline coordinator, it has sort of the provision that authorizes that pipeline coordinator to get in and make sure that other state agencies don't slow down the process. And it was viewed that if a collateral project or another project didn't have the benefit of that, that was in essence saying the state was going to not handle their permitting or not handle the process for them. And what was brought out in the testimony was that there actually is a provision in the Department of Natural Resources existing statutes under which they manage large projects and are currently managing large projects. And they assign someone within DNR to be the large project coordinator, and they move through in that process. It is not as detailed and is not have kind of the profile that this coordinator does, but there is a process for other pipelines where they would proceed to manage their permitting and their right-of-ways, et cetera. Section 120 is the actual request.
Marcia, just a second.
Senator Huggins.
Chairman, thank you. I mean, I have confidence, if you will, that, you know, the department will do all they can for any competing projects. I think it is fair to point out, however, that our state pipeline coordinator, in my understanding, is tailored after the federal. That's what I've been told.
Yes, that's correct.
But there is a difference in the language. The federal pipeline coordinator says any project, mm-hmm. and the state says the project. So I think in all fairness, we have to point mm-hmm. that at the contrast to the task as it's delineated to the two different people.
Could you bring forward the federal language on the pipeline coordinator to the committee?
Yes, sir.
And we can do a comparison of the language between the two. Thank you, Senator Huggins.
Section 120, which is the request for applications for the license. This is the provision that directs the commissioners to develop the what we call the RFA. In other parlances, it's the request for proposals, but in this case, request for applications. And the commissioners are to develop that as soon as possible after the effective date of the chapter in reality, because of the concerns about mitigating and eliminating delay. We're beginning that process now just to ensure that we have an RFA ready to go as soon as possible. And in this provision, one of the changes that came about through the committee process, this used to direct the commissioners to do this within 90 days. And the legislative attorney, in his wisdom, said you just never know what's going to happen. So when you have legislative mandates that says you will do something within 90 days, sure shoot, and something will happen that will throw you off your game. So that section has been moved to the back of the bill in the what I'll call the goal or aspirational language in the back, where it's directing the commissioners to do so as soon as practicable and with a goal of being it within 90 days.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Elton.
And I'm assuming, Marcia, that's okay with the administration, the amendment that was made?
Yes. I mean, our goal is to do it sooner than 90 days, so we're gonna well hit that mark, and we appreciate others' wisdom about deadlines and how they can bite you, but obviously our own internal goal is to beat that by a margin.
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Please continue.
Section 130 contains the application requirements, and this section has been known or made known to a lot of folks as being the list of items that contain what we call the state's must-haves embedded within them. And I'll walk through the different criteria that are going to be required. Obviously, there's a deadline for the request for applications to be submitted. They need to provide the detailed description of the project, the route, the receipt and delivery points, the size and design capacity at those points, the economic analysis, technical viability of the project. In addition, one of the adds to the bill through the legislative process has been on page 4 between lines 6 and 8. I believe it was
Thank you, Marcia. Let's go back and go through them. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Okay. One is the deadline on page 3, line 22. Number 2 on line 24 is the detailed description of the project, and it breaks out in subparagraphs A, B, C, and D, and proceeds on. This is probably the longest section, one of the longest sections in this listing of criteria, because it focuses on the description of the project itself. And so what you'll find in subheading B, A is the route, B are the receipt and delivery points. C is an analysis of the project's economic and technical viability. D lists the economic and technical viability of the work plan, the timeline, and associated budget, including a description of how the applicant is going to perform their field work, their environmental studies, their design and engineering. And the next element was added by the legislature, which is how the applicant will implement practices for controlling carbon emissions from natural gas systems as established by the EPA. And again, this is concerned that with future global warming issues, we need to be mindful of that issue as we select applicants in this project, because there can be carbon emission impacts. And in addition, how the applicant's going to comply with state, federal, and international laws. Then specifically, there's a breakout of two types of projects that would require special attention, special focus, and that is under Romanet I on line 11 of page 4. We carve out the Canadian throughway issues, which would entail having the applicant describe if the project does require going through, transiting through Canada, giving us specific details about the right-of-way situations, their capabilities, and the regulatory issues involving Canada. Romanet 2, that begins on line 17, focuses on the specific details that relate to a liquefied natural gas project. Again, keep in mind, the AGIA process does not prejudge what type of project can be submitted. It could be an all-in-state line for gas. It could be an in-state with an export for LNG. It could be a combination of those, one or both of those, with a gas line that would transit through Canada into the lower 48 or into just Canada. So there's a wide range of projects that this bill has to back up and make sure that it's got language that covers and enables commissioners to make a proper analysis. Number 3 on the list is on page 5, beginning on line 3. This is the project that calls for the applicant to give date certains. And this will run through on subsection A, is the one hard deadline that the AGIA bill imposes upon an applicant, and that is that they have an open season no later than 36 months after the date the license is issued.
Could we stop there for a minute? Mm-hmm. And can you elaborate on the 36 month and then the difference between an open, or I should say a binding open season and potentially an unsuccessful open season?
The process by which an applicant has an open season is guided in good part by FERC. They set out specific procedures for the manner in which an open season is to be held. An open season is simply a period of time that the pipeline company says, I've put out this information, here's the data, I would like to invite the market to come forward and offer to ship on my pipeline. And it's not a date, it's not a single date, it's a process that has to last, I believe, at least 6 months. And so it's you open a period of time of 6 months in which you wait for the market and you have dialogue with the market, you encourage the market to come forward. And in that time period, you will be offering up what you believe are the likely tariffs, the likely structures. This is a period of time of negotiation for the pipeline with its shippers. And in this time period, it will either get commitments from shippers that say, sure, sign me up for the base rate, the rack rate, or They'll say, you know, we're going to be doing a lot of business with you. We'd like to ship for this period of time for this volume of gas. We'd like to negotiate our own rate. And that's a time period when they can actually negotiate a rate as opposed to take the FERC-approved, you know, rack rate kind of structure. But this time period is the testing of the market. This is when the pipeline company finds out if they've done their homework and they've structured a project that will meet the needs of that market. And it's a process that lasts for up to 6 months. And once the pipeline company has tested the market and seen the response, either they figure out that they didn't size the pipeline big enough, or they find out that they got it just right, or they find out that they've got more pipe than they've got gas being offered. And that's when they step back and they ask themselves, do I believe that my design is correct and that there's still more market demand out there that I just haven't been able to attract and I need to do more work to attract it? Or did I size my pipe wrong and I need to downsize my pipe to match what is in fact the real market demand? So it's a very fluid time period, this open season. It's a give and take process between the pipeline company and the market and the dialogue. And as a result of when the cutoff happens and the pipeline company says, okay, I think I've got all the response I'm going to get, the pipeline company takes that information and then decides how they're going to proceed from that point. So when we talk about an open season being successful or unsuccessful, that's a little bit of a, it's not a useful label because it really, it's sort of in the eye of the beholder, in this case, in the eye of the pipeline company, how it wants to respond to the responses it got in its open season. But obviously, a pipeline company that's set up to have a 4.5 BCF a day pipe, and they've only gotten shippers interested in about 1 billion cubic feet of that space, they've got an issue. And after they have that open season, they'll need to figure out what the market reasons were for why their design didn't match the market. And they'll have several ways to proceed from that point, depending upon what their analysis tells them about the mismatch.
Could you address the 36 months a little more detail? Issue being that this proposed project, you know, has been worked on extensively. Proposed project meaning gas line into Northern Alaska the last several years versus starting with a fresh idea into a new basin. Why we would have 36 months instead of 24 months or 18 months? Why would we have such a long time frame?
Senator Stedman, I'm joined here at the table by Anthony Scott, who is the DNR's what I'll call resident expert on FERC issues, and I would like him to see if he can address that question.
Sure. Go ahead and identify yourself for the record, and you know the drill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Anthony Scott. I'm a commercial analyst in the Division of Oil and Gas for the Department of Natural Resources. This is the only mandated date in the bill in terms of when an entity must do something by a particular date. It was important for us not to prejudge how an open season should be conducted, where the level of data that would be assembled. What we recognized that was that 36 months gave essentially any applicant, no matter who they were, two full field seasons to assess root, soils, whatever it is that they needed to assess to be able to put together a credible project. There are some potential applicants who may be able to move to an open season more quickly. As Mr. Chairman, you recognize, I mean, I think that is correct, that there's some potential applicants who could potentially move to an open season more quickly because they've already done a tremendous amount of work. Presumably, that would work in their favor in the application process because that goes to the issue, hopefully, of timing and when we could expect first gas. But again, we didn't want to prejudge what an appropriate approach would be to conducting an open season. This gives enough time two full field seasons, but we didn't want to sort of prescribe and impose artificial limitations about what could or should be done.
So is it fair to conclude then from yesterday's testimony that a one-year delay at 5.5 as far as the price of gas is $1.8 billion, this could be a fairly expensive extension, all else being equal, from 24 to 36 months?
Senator Stedman, yes, that's right. So again, entities that have already conducted a fair amount of work and could presumably move to an open season after only one field season. Again, in terms of the evaluation criteria, you're exactly right that assuming the timing of the open season sets up a process that leads you to first gas in a reasonably defined period of time, you know, the earlier you start that process, the earlier you get to first gas, and indeed improved net present value for the state.
So when the analysis was done on creation of the bill, where did the 36 months come from? As far as, you know, was it asked by any particular entity or group, or was there economic analysis done or comparisons or?
No, Mr. Chairman. Again, the desire was to permit enough time, given the timing of when this would move forward, the bill would move forward, and then we would get applicants and a license awarded, to ensure that we provided at least two field seasons. We are, having spent years in negotiation, quite sensitive to not wanting to tell people how they must conduct their business and what an appropriate open season and the preparatory work for that would be. So we wanted to give enough time, and then the idea is, by setting out a competitive playing field, and because, as you point out, delay costs the state, by evaluating comparative bids on the basis of net present value, you will create a competitive impetus to move this forward more quickly.
I think Senator Elton was first, and then Senator Huggins.
Thanks. And is there a reason for the wording on the 36-month hard deadline? I mean, couldn't you do it one of two ways? You could say conclude an open season within 36 months, or begin an open season within 30 months. I'm not familiar with the FERC process, but is there a reason for this language rather than beginning an open season within 30 months?
Senator Elton, through the chair, again, the intention was to provide any applicant at least two field seasons to do the work necessary to conduct an open season. The open season process, which has been mandated in the federal legislation, and there are regulations for that, is a fairly lengthy process. It will take around 6 months to go through the entire process between presenting your open season plan to the FERC, and then the FERC has got 30 days to say, yes, that's a good open season plan, and then you get it back, and then you actually start conducting your open season. But again, we wanted to provide any applicant at least two full field seasons, and the opportunity then to incorporate the results of those field seasons into their work.
Maybe I could ask the question a little bit differently. And again, I recognize that I'm not the kind of person somebody would come to as an expert on FERC, but are open seasons ever extended by FERC?
Senator Elton, through the chair, I apologize for not picking up where you were going with the question. And you're exactly right. In general, in the lower 48, FERC does not have regulations for conducting open seasons. Open seasons are essentially commercial practices between parties, and it's the mechanism that FERC uses to ensure that you've got non-discrimination under the Natural Gas Act. This is the only project which has got regulations. The regulations require certain minimum periods of time. They don't specify maximum periods of time. And so it is entirely possible that if we didn't say conclude it by a certain date, you could have somebody start it and the open season theoretically could continue for a number of years, which is not what anybody particularly wants. We want to have an open season where it's clear what the termination date is and get it done, and we'll see where we are at that point.
Thanks, Tony. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Senator Huggins, I think you had a question, then Senator Hoffman.
Well, Anthony, I still think it is worth at least the committee to see the backup rationale for why it would be not 30 months or 24 months. I mean, 36 months may be the perfect number, but what about the alternatives? I mean, why are they imperfect, I guess would be my question. And I think it's important to understand that for us to be in a comfort zone. I assume you have the backup data for it, so it would be at least informative, if nothing else.
Thank you, Senator Huggins. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In yesterday's presentation on the GIA, one of the must-haves was having a pipeline sooner. And under this provision, are the applicants going to be asked how soon within this 36 months can they conclude? And if so, how much weight is going to be given to individuals that can, say, provide this process, complete this process in a 12-month period versus a 36-month period?
Senator Hoffman, through the chair, yes, the structure of GIA actually requires the applicant to tell us the date, give us their date by which they will conclude the open season. And by pegging that and saying this is the date we will have our open season concluded by, it is one factor that would be looked at relative to the value in evaluating what the net present value of the project is to the state, because it gives us a sense of their timeline. However, we also will have experts that will judge the credibility of that date, because another factor of the evaluation is the likelihood of success. So if you have an applicant that's picked a date that is doesn't look like it would be conducive to having a successful open season, in other words, they've picked an unrealistic date or an unrealistically early date given the amount of information and data they have developed themselves, that would counterbalance an early date. So it is a weighing factor of, is it an early date, earlier date than the other applicants, and is it a credible date? And those would be the evaluation that we would apply to a date certain. But yes, they are required to give us a date by which they give us their own deadline.
But, Mr. Chairman, but you're not saying how much weight would be given to someone if they say there were only two applicants and one applicant said they could do it within 12 months and the other applicant said they can do it within 36 months. And you determine both of them to be credible, then the advantage would go to the company or corporation that could accomplish the task in 12 months, and weigh that with, under that category, they would be preferred. But you're not saying how much weight would be given to this as compared to other criteria?
Senator Hoffman, when we get to a couple sections later, we're going to come to a section called the evaluation criteria. And that is going to set out the formula or the methodology that the commissioners would use to rank in each of the applications. And that criteria sets up essentially an analysis that is, what is the net present value of that project to the state? And this factor is one of the factors that would affect that net present value calculation. And so if that was the only factor that we were analyzing, you are correct that we would give dominance to, we would rank an application ahead of the other application, given that one was earlier than the other and they were equally likely and credible. But there are multiples of factors, so it would flow into the math and affect how we evaluate and rank the project.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Hoffman. Senator Elton. Thomas, that had a question. Senator Thomas.
Somebody on that side of the table.
Somebody on that side of the table.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Along the same lines, I'm sure you must have taken into consideration the inducements and how they were, you know, the amounts and the timing of them. I shouldn't say I'm sure, but did you consider that those might have had some impact on the time frame of the 36 months, reducing it and making it, you know, if you will spend, we'll give you so much over this period of time, so much over this period of time, and so much over this period of time?
Senator Thomas, that is exactly correct, and that's part of the weighing of the net present value of the project to the state. When the state's money goes out, the timing of it balanced against, obviously, how it affects a date certain. And you can see it gets to be a bit complex in terms of analyzing the value of the project to the state, because each of these factors is not only standalone important, they interact with one another as well.
If I may, just quickly. I understand that we all want to hurry ahead, and your production from the slideshow indicates some of the urgency of getting it done earlier, so I guess I would be inclined to almost take a look at the 36 months in relationship to the way the money is divvied out and be a little top-heavy on the money in the earlier days to urge that process along, because I think we all believe that it's a very marketable product that we have here. So anyhow, just a comment. Thank you.
Please continue.
Subsection B is the second category of activity for which we ask the applicant to focus and give us a date certain. This activity is called the pre-filing procedures of the FERC. And what this is essentially a process that FERC has in place to facilitate the ultimate FERC certification process. And its focus is significantly on the environmental evaluations of the project, so it gets that project going and in the pipe and clicking along in a more efficient manner. And it helps streamline the FERC certification process if an applicant partakes of this pre-filing procedure. It's not required currently under FERC procedures for a non-LNG project, so this is a requirement we're asking the applicant to participate in, even though it's not required. It's an area where the state can do something to help encourage quicker action than otherwise would happen. And so we're not setting a date that they have to initiate these pre-filing procedures, but we're asking them to give us their deadline by which they'll engage in these pre-filing procedures. Subsection C is the actual application for the FERC certificate. And again, we're asking them to apply for it by a date certain. We're not telling them what the date is. We're asking them to give us their deadline by which they will file for this certificate. Note that this one is not one where we're asking them to get a certificate by a certain date, because obviously filing for it and going through the procedures, once they get into that process, they don't control the pace by which FERC will ultimately issue the certificate.
If we could stop there, you're ready to go on to number four? Okay, I'll stop there for a minute. One of the potential exposures for time that the state faces if we don't have as much success as open season as we'd like, and we go to the FERC certificate and we match the 80 cents on the dollar and we go for this FERC certificate without enough FTs to construct whatever, you know, we're hoping to construct. So can you bring back to the committee how often that process is done elsewhere? Is this a common way large lines are built or large projects or not? And what projects have had failed open seasons, driven onto the FERC certificate? Which ones were successful and not successful?
Yes, sir. We'll do that.
Continue number four.
Item number four is a provision that is the analog to number three, but in a setting where the project is not governed by FERC, but rather by the Regulatory Commission of Alaska, which means that the project would be an in-state project. And again, it has a parallel requirement of concluding an open season within 36 months under A, and B, a requirement that they apply for the certificate from the RCA by a date certain. Number five, on line five, is the commitment that we're requiring of applicants that they assess market demand for additional pipeline capacity at least every 2 years through non-binding solicitation. And what this means is when a pipeline, once you've got its design set and you've gone out and you're having your open season and you've told people, this is the pipe I'm going to build, this is what I want to do, there can be resistance to change and resistance as the market starts to come in with a lot of extra gas. And as has been described to this, I believe to this committee already, certainly to previous committees, the success of the Alaska Natural Gas Pipeline is going to depend in part long-term on expansion, on new gas coming in from other fields that will come in as other gas declines, backfilling those pipes and essentially continuing. So there needs to be a cycle of renewal of gas resources over time. And in order to do that, the explorationists need to look ahead and be able to say, okay, in X years ahead, I will have the opportunity to put my gas in a pipeline. And the opportunity to do that depends upon that pipeline company's willingness to look out and make solicitations in a fairly regular period and solicit interest in expansion. And by soliciting it, it basically enables that pipeline, that explorationist, to know and start to benchmark when they'd be able to get their gas in and on what terms. So what we're asking the pipeline company to do is commit to do that every 2 years through non-binding solicitations or similar means. There's been some criticism of this provision by industry because of concern that in a typical setting, when a pipeline company goes and solicits interest in expansion, they do so in a fairly formal process where they okay, I'm going to let Anthony take this.
Actually, provisions 5 and 6 are designed to ensure that whoever owns the pipeline will act like a pipeline company. It is regularly the case that non-binding open seasons are held all the time. Non-binding open seasons are merely solicitations of interest. Is there anybody out there who is interested in capacity? And if there is sufficient interest to support an economic expansion, then or it looks that way, then a pipeline company will later, subsequent to that initial expression of interest, go out and conduct a formal binding open season in which people actually put their money where their mouth is. So all that 5 really does is provide for a mechanism where solicitations of interest of some sort are acquired. There's no need that this be at all an expensive process. There need be no engineering or design work behind it. This is a process to solicit interest for new capacity. If there is adequate interest for new capacity, such that people are actually willing to put their money where their mouth is, Section 6 of the bill then would kick in, where the pipeline company would then commit to expand the project in reasonable engineering increments on commercially viable terms. So 5 is merely creates a public process by which 6 gets implemented.
I think there's been, like you'd mentioned, considerable interest in this. Clearly, this is a basin opening project, and it's to the best interest of the state to open the basin up, have more exploration and development, you know, in the Arctic, along with the ability to access the offshore issues, offshore gas.
And Senator Stedman, on paragraph 5, the point I was making that as Mr. Scott has indicated, 5 does not require the expensive sort of binding process where there's a lot of engineering and design. It was written purposefully to be through public non-binding solicitation or similar means. This could be a fairly loose process, and we're not prescribing here an expensive process for the reach into the market to test interest in expansion under Section 5.
I guess there's two areas of concern that have been, at least two that have been brought up. One of them is prior to first gas, an impact that this clause may have on a bunch of design and engineering or possibly even construction that has taken place. Mm-hmm. And then the other one is the relative frequency of it. It's pretty hard to, I think, argue that it shouldn't take place, but is how common is the two-year clause across the states? Is it, you know, we find that in pretty much all the agreements, or where did the 2 years come from?
Mr. Chairman, in the lower 48, I am personally not aware of any pipeline which is on a sort of fixed schedule for when they're soliciting demand on a formal or informal basis. We recognize that this project is different. There's only going to be one. There are not going to be competing projects, almost certainly. So we face a different circumstance in the lower 48, and we also recognize that it could well be the case that the producer group also owns the pipeline. And if the producer group were interested in merely earning pipeline returns, it's probably the case that this project would already be underway. Now, no one's suggesting that they shouldn't be interested in earning considerably greater returns than pipeline returns. I'm not suggesting that at all. But the point is that the producer groups, who they are as companies, is geared not towards the steady, relatively modest returns that pipeline companies enjoy. That's not their target focus. So the 2 year schedule is something new, but we do say or similar means, and one of the reasons why we said or similar means was that it's perfectly it would be reasonable, certainly serve the state's interest, if a pipeline entity, whoever owned it, engaged in a process which is common in Canada. In Canada, tariffs have basically a queuing system where the pipeline sets out and they say, okay, well, anybody who's interested in capacity in the future, let us know. And there's basically a list, and it's first come, first serve. And so when enough capacity sort of shows up on the list to support a reasonable expansion, then the expansion occurs. So what we're driving here is some reasonable periodic interval in which demand is solicited. We didn't want to get too much into how it must occur. But it needs to be adequately periodic to support the kind of robust exploration development that we all hope to see.
So was that run through some kind of economic analysis or modeling, or was it, how did the time frame come up, Mr. Chairman? No,
it was not. We didn't want to say every 6 months or every 2 weeks, or there was recognition it needed to be a sufficiently long period so that you didn't have kind of so that the process was in some way meaningful. But we also needed a short enough period so that folks who have land positions and are interested in exploring for and developing hydrocarbons have got reasonable predictability about when they can commercialize those. So if the committee deems in its wisdom that it wants to change this from 2 years to 18 months or something like that, I don't think that there would be enormous heartache around that.
Has there been an analysis done on Anadarko and Pioneer and the other smaller companies up there when they'll have capacity of gas of sufficient amounts to be able to come and participate in the line?
Mr. Chairman, that's a chicken and egg problem. One of the things that we certainly hope, and one of the reasons why the date certain for the open season is important, is to get this process moving so that there's increased predictability for those parties to begin to spend the exploration dollars to prove up the reserves that we all hope and expect that they have. So it is unlikely that the what we can loosely call the explorer companies will be able to prove up hydrocarbons in time to participate in the initial open season. It is one of the reasons actually why it's important to keep the process moving past an open season, because we fully expect actually that those parties, once they know a project is project is coming, that they indeed will expend dollars and prove up reserves in time to participate after that initial period, whether it's 1 year after, 18 months, or what have you. That question's better directed, I think, to them.
Okay. I'm going to probably word this question not as technically correct as not being an oil and gas guy, as I should, but when we do this line, and maybe it has initial capacity of 4.5 BCF, maybe it's expandable to 6, some ballpark numbers that seem to come up quite a bit in the analysis, and we can, you know, assume to do that type of volume or running a line down a continent into Canada. Clearly there's an interest in the state in seeing the basin opened up, and we get more players up there, we have more exploration and expansion, and we have the ability, like you've just mentioned, for these newer applicants that have substantially less volumes of gas to be able to enter into the gas line and sell their product. But we also have, I think it's roughly 52 or somewhere right over 50% of the potential reserve capacity laying offshore, where the state of Alaska would not get its as much economic activity off of it as we do on the North Slope. And what kind of analysis or processes has there been anything done on that particular issue to see what impact that may have in squeezing out these smaller companies onshore that we're trying to see expand, so they, one, don't have the ability to access what I'll use, the feeder lines. It's more of an oil issue. There's another term, and I can't remember right now, to feed into the GDP and then out down the line. There's also the issue of just capacity in the line, but before you can get to that point, you got to get it to it. So can you enlighten me a little bit on that in the committee on the potential risk that Alaska may be facing and the potential squeeze out that we may face from the offshore federal? I'm assuming that the folks offshore are going to want to use that gas line to ship the product.
Senator Stedman, I assume that too. I think it's safe to say that we simply do not know the pace, the relative pace of different developments and when they are going to have hydrocarbons ready to put into the gas line, and hopefully they'll find some oil as well to put into taps. We just do not know. We can't say, standing here today, which gas will come when. That is a function of various corporate strategies that, frankly, we're not privy to. And so one of the reasons why, on balance, I mean, you're anticipating a little bit some of the later must-haves around rolled-in rates. One of the reasons on balance why We strongly believe that the rolled-in rate provisions are in the state's interest is because it is not at all it is entirely possible that offshore gas could come in and fill the relatively inexpensive expansion capacity first. And in that event, without rolled-in rates, gas from state lands might have to wait 15 or more years until Prudhoe Bay starts coming off decline before there's adequate capacity at an economic rate to get into the pipeline. So given the uncertainties on balance, we think it is clearly in the state's interest to have a level playing field for all gas across the board. In addition, and this is slightly kind of a step out, but the rolled-in rates provision in AGEA, there's no question that because it creates a level playing field, it opens potentially opportunities for offshore gas to come into the project, which is certainly in the federal government's interest. That will be helpful as we move forward in this process. It will also be helpful in the state's effort to try to obtain a royalty share from the OCS gas, which is more than 6 miles offshore, which is something which is of some interest now, and people are working on that, and I think it'll improve our position actually as a state to obtaining that kind of share. Now, whether we will or not, don't know.
We're rolling into rolled-in rates. That's the next one, but just a second. Could you, for the folks at home, give us a quick synopsis of why we would be concerned about offshore gas from a revenue perspective of the state, and so people at home can follow the concern that all gas is not equal to the state treasury?
I'd be happy to, Mr. Chairman. In general, on state lands, I mean, there are exceptions, but in general, on state lands, the state's royalty share is 1/8 or 12.5%. The state's, and so, 12.5% royalty rate. On federal onshore lands, the state typically receives half of the Fed's royalty share. So typically, you're looking at 12.5% federal royalty rate, and the state's share of that would be 50%. So the state will clearly benefit merely from a royalty perspective for gas that comes in on state lands, greater Prudhoe Bay area, Point Thompson, the foothills, very perspective, than in NPRA. Gas produced within offshore in the 3 to 6 miles offshore, the state typically, I believe, receives, it's on the order of a quarter, 25% of the federal royalty share. I think it may be 27%, but I'm not positive. Don't quote me on that. But it's right about a quarter, 25% of the federal's royalty share. So certainly the state would prefer that gas come in, say, the NPRA prior to the 3 to 6 mile, gas from 3 to 6 miles. Beyond 6 miles, you're in what's, you know, the real Outer Continental Shelf offshore, and the state does not currently receive a royalty share from those lands. There's a similar, although distinct, story to tell about taxes. Production tax is levied on state lands, on the federal onshore, and I actually, Marsha's the tax person here, I'm a little fuzzy on how it works from 3 to 6, and from 6 and beyond, I'm pretty sure we don't levy.
Well, maybe so we don't burn up a lot of time. The point I was driving at is all gas is not equal to the state treasury. Clearly, there's a substantial amount of gas potential offshore where the state, along with what then goes into the permanent fund, will get impacted relative if it was all state land gas going down the gas line. And if you could bring back to the committee kind of a summary of the expected volumes that we're looking at, and I know there's a lot of the subjectivity to that, but it would be nice to just give the committee members a feel for the expected volumes of gas that are laying out in these regions. And then as we roll into the and start dealing with the rolled-in rates, it does come into play with what we could expect. But Senator Dyson had a question.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. You're getting at some very pertinent issues, and it calls to mind a kind of related question. If, you know, I think we all would realize that a proposal from the producers who have the capacity to commit gas, you know, will be attractive. I worry about a producer proposal that at its real goal is to continue to maximize oil production and profits off the Trans-Alaska oil pipeline, and may indeed a major factor may be just the reservoir dynamics and the ultimate, you know, production of oil. And so if indeed we got a proposal that real goal was to maximize oil production and or control the basin, and may indeed want to delay the gas production and or access to the pipeline, and of course the state's interests are very different, you know, on those. How in the world do we go about, or you all go about evaluating those very different goals that might come up for a producer? Tough question, awkwardly stated.
Senator Dyson, through the chair, as we get in applications, these are hugely expensive commitments by companies that are bringing in applications. And they obviously don't put it in with the idea that if accepted, you know, they're going to walk away. I mean, they're going to put time and money into pulling together applications and presenting them. And I don't think that we would expect that any of those applications are going to be, because of the amount of money involved, are going to be disingenuous. We believe that the applications are going to be represent what they say they represent, which is here's the plan we propose to make. It's very factual. We're not asking them to opine sort of at the pace of the gas offtake that they're going to have. It's basically the application's about building a pipeline. And we have to ourselves do our own forecasting and conjecturing as to, you know, how the gas will flow in. But the application itself is about building a pipeline. And it's going to have a cost associated. It's going to have a timing associated with it. And it's going to have credibility, you know, lots or little, whatever it is, in terms of its likelihood of success. And so we have to look at that and take it at face value and assume that if we've got producers that have stepped forward and put together an application where they're committing to spend $20 to $30 billion, they're not gaming it from that standpoint. That's a legitimate effort at building a pipeline. With that said, when we stop and say, okay, since it's going to be a producer-owned pipeline and a basin that has a lot of producer involvement, the design of AGEA has built in from the get-go tools that enable or ensure that that basin is not locked up. And we recognize that once you've given a license to a group of people to build a pipeline and they're off and running, that's their pipeline. And we as a state have certain regulatory rights, but that is their business, that is their pipeline. And our ability to tell them what to do or what not to do is limited by whatever the appropriate jurisdictional rights are through the RCA or the powers and authorities of FERC. So there are agencies out there designed to ensure that fair competition happens on that pipeline, that appropriate rates and tariffs are being charged, and that the access rights are being managed. With that said, in AGEA, looking ahead and anticipating what could go wrong, that is why we have certain must-haves in the AGEA, a commitment by whoever that pipeline applicant is, that they will look around every 2 years and look to see if there's expansion opportunities. And if there is appropriate expansion, that they will do so. And finally, what we're going to get ready to go into is how the cost of that expansion will be borne by the shippers and the pipeline company. So with the, we've also got a few other must-haves we haven't gotten to, which is the debt equity structure for rate purposes. So we have some elements that we're going to hardwire from the beginning that will protect the state's interest without going overboard. But as far as being concerned whether or not a producer-owned pipeline is going to dampened, its economics dampened because of concern about what they're doing with the oil, we have to remind ourselves we have a stake in the oil as well as a state. You know, we benefit from oil production as well and from the continuing flow of oil through TAPS. So one must hope that we've got good alignment, the state's economics with the producer's economics, subject to a couple elements that we've put into AGEA that ensure fair play.
We're out of time. If we can have just a brief follow-up by Senator Dyson, then we'll pick it back up at 3 o'clock.
I'm sorry, did you say I can ask a follow-on?
Yeah, just a brief one, but we'll pick it up at 3 o'clock.
So my concern is that we don't know enough about the optimum gas offtake rate that maintains the oil production and that the producers do. And so our evaluating, do we have the tools to evaluate what is the max? You know, it may be that 1.6 is the maximum, the reservoir take off take for the next 4 or 5 years that allows us to maintain oil production. Do we have the reservoir information that we need to evaluate the, whoever's application?
Senator Dyson, you raise a very good question, and it's probably going to be one that maybe the committee will want to look at as a topic, because I know that we'll be doing that. But that's going to relate to the AOGCC
yes.
and its role in determining what the appropriate gas offtake rate should be for Prudhoe and any of the other fields and how that process happens. But the short answer is yes, the agency is vested with the responsibility of managing that gas offtake rate. It has done so currently with the producers. The producers have developed reservoir data. The state possesses the data, but what the state does not possess is this large model, this computer model that takes the data and chews it up and spits out sort of conclusions about impacts on reservoir. But the producers to date have made that available to the AOGCC under the confidentiality provisions, and I would have full confidence that the state, the DNR participants as an interested party and an involved party would likewise be brought under the tent to look at that. Whether third parties can, I doubt that, like an independent pipeline
company.
Let's
stop there. We'll pick it up at 3 o'clock. And continue our work. The meeting will stand in recess.